Hello. On SITREP this week, Ukraine's ex-Royal Navy mine hunters are on exercise in Scottish waters. Simon Newton joins me and Mike to explain Exercise Sea Breeze. NATO's next Secretary General is named, but what does the top job in the world's largest military alliance require, and how does Mark Rutte measure up? And how a radio interview heard by chance led a young medical student into 2 decades of military service and a world-leading career improving military mental health. Professor Neil Greenberg tells us about the moment that made him.
I really wanted to make a difference in my life, and I think people who don't know a lot about psychiatry assume that you do a lot of listening, but you don't necessarily get people better. And the good news, I can assure you and listeners, is that people do get better.
SITREP
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, before we talk about the Ukrainian Navy, Mike, it's been 2 years since the Army began training Ukrainians in the UK on Operation Interflex. Around 40,000 have now been through the 5-week intensive course. So it's proving successful.
It's certainly well regarded, and it's created good infantry soldiers, drills and skills, as they always say. The issue is really that the Ukrainians need more command experience and command training. So they're middle level and sort of mid to upper level commanders. And that seems to have been somewhat lacking, because the Ukrainians find that they're caught between being a sort of Western Army and an old Red Army style organization. And it's the mid level. So it's not the basic infantry training that is a problem, although they need more of it. But what they're getting from Britain is regarded very highly. But it's a more complex problem to train the command level. You know, famously, Alexander the Great is said to have said, you know, I'm not afraid of an army of lions led by sheep, but I am afraid of an army of sheep led by lions. It's all about commanders.
Well, efforts to equip and train Ukraine's armed forces may be focused on the current land battle, but they also go beyond that. Last year, the Royal Navy handed 2 Sandown-class mine hunters to Ukraine. The ongoing conflict means the ships are still not in the Black Sea, where they're intended to work. Instead, they're in Scotland. Well, right now, members of the Ukrainian Navy are sailing them in a multinational mine clearance exercise, Sea Breeze, off the Scottish coast. Well, SITREP's Simon Newton was in Glasgow as it got underway. Hi, Simon. Can you tell us more about the exercise?
Okay, yeah, this is a 2-week exercise. It's actually the 23rd iteration of Sea Breeze. It's led by the US Navy, hosted by the Royal Navy, because it's in Scotland. But this year, it's primarily about Ukraine. HMS Shoreham and HMS Grimsby, which were these 2 Sandown-class mine hunters gifted, transferred to Ukraine, are now based in Portsmouth with their crews doing this training. And this is a chance really for them to practice mine hunting off the coast of Scotland, and really critically to do that alongside NATO countries. So there's ships from Ukraine, from France, from Germany and Estonia. Plus, there's also personnel from 13 nations up there on this exercise, including even some sailors from Japan taking part.
So the intended destination for these mine hunters is the Black Sea. Just how heavily mined is it?
Well, Russia's thought to put about 400 to 600 or so mines into the Black Sea around Crimea, for instance, and to protect the Kerch Bridge, which is that link, obviously, to the mainland. Moscow says that Ukraine, in turn, has also sown about 400 or so mines of its own, because they feared, if you remember, at the beginning of the war, there was going to be this amphibious landing around Odessa by the Russians. So there's a lot of them in there. Many of them are this sort of Soviet era YAM mines, which contain about 20 kilos or so of TNT. Plus, of course, there are mines in there from the Second World War as well. So, and it's not a huge area. The Black Sea is only, 220 miles long, 110 miles wide. So, and there have been casualties so far because of them. There's been a number of commercial vessels damaged. At least one has been sunk. And also even some swimmers along, you know, the coast of Romania, Bulgaria have been killed from these mines. So I asked Commodore Dmitry Kovalenko, who's the head of training for the Ukrainian Navy, just how dangerous the Black Sea is right now.
The Black Sea now is one of the most dangerous seas in the world ocean, because the amount of mines that Russia has used in our waters has made it absolutely impossible to use for civilian and military shipment and training as well.
Ukraine relies on the export of grain and other goods from there. How vital is it that you clear these waterways?
Ну, Україна
Ukraine is now managing to clear the so-called grain corridor in order to provide international trading and shipment. We do that by our own small MCM groups. They are now working in the sea and in the shore and in port areas. The corridor gives us an opportunity to pass 4,000 ships and more than 52 million of tons of cargo of different types.
So as you heard him say there, really, they are starting this process of demining using these smaller vessels. But for now, because of this Montreux Convention, which was signed back in 1936, I think, it means that under that international law, Turkey can and actually has stopped Ukraine sending these mine hunters through the Bosphorus Strait and into the Black Sea, where they could actually, you know, do the job they're designed to do.
So, Simon, what capability do these two ex-Royal Navy vessels offer to the eventual job of clearance of the Black Sea?
Well, these mine hunters are, and they may be getting on a little bit. They were built, I think Shoreham was built in 2001 or so, but they're still very capable. I actually filmed Shoreham in Bahrain when it was deployed on Opkipian in the Gulf for a number of years. And the Royal Navy is very good at mine hunting, has a great history in that, and it's passing all of that knowledge on to the Ukrainians. These Sandown class vessels have very powerful sonar, which can see something, I think, about the size of a football from a kilometer or so away. And the Ukrainians are being trained on Seafox, which is an autonomous system that can go down, look at a mine on the bottom of the seabed, and if needs be, detonate it. So it's still a very good bit of kit, and mine hunting really is a real skill, as Commodore Steve Banfield from the Royal Navy told me.
It's a bit like trying to play 3D chess, because you're looking for an object through a body of water which you can't see through only by sound. You are interpreting sonar pictures. Once you have an idea that you may have a mine, you then have to use your autonomous and your uncrewed system skills in order to go down and investigate that contact to determine whether it is a threat. Once you've determined whether it is a threat, you then have to figure out the best way to dispose of that mine, and that may be with an uncrewed system, or you may have to put divers in the water. So not only is it highly complex, you're doing it in a highly dangerous area where you know very well that the conditions can be entirely hostile, all the while trying not to do anything like set the mine off or indeed run over another mine. So it is like 3D chess under fire.
And the Commodore really was very full of praise. I'm questioning about that, of the Ukrainians, of those sailors, about their focus on what they're having to learn. And as we often say, on their absolute belief in a future victory.
Mike, it might seem odd to some that effort is being put into eventually clearing mines in the Black Sea right now when there is no end in sight of the war. Why is it so important?
Yes, I mean, when these two mine hunters were gifted to Ukraine, I think there was some thought that they might be able to negotiate it with Turkey to get them through because they were, you know, clearing sea mines in order to help maritime traffic. But as Simon said, Turkey, you know, stuck to the Montreux Convention of 1936. They won't allow any warships through the straits, and mine clearance vessels count as a warship. So you can sort of understand that. I did wonder whether they could get them through the Danube. And I was looking at some of the depths and the bridges. I mean, there's plenty of depth in the Danube to sail them right into the Black Sea through the Danube, but you can't get them through some of the bridges, it seems. But it did seem like a possibility at one time, but they haven't tried it. So the issue is that at some point, the Ukrainians will need to clear the mines because they want to keep the Black Sea open. And so, you know, thinking of the future, assuming that Ukraine survives this war, at some point they will have to deal with these, you know, several hundred, and it'll maybe more by then, mines, which are a threat to its maritime traffic, because Ukraine, more than most other Black Sea states, depends upon passage in and through the Bosphorus for its trade, given its importance in the agricultural trade of cereals and crops in the world.
And Simon, when the time does come, is it going to be down to the Ukrainians to clear these mines on their own?
Well, a lot was made at the launch in Glasgow that it would be a team effort. This was by the sort of senior American commanders there. So there was a definite nod there to Ukraine's future within NATO. And I think it's worth stressing that other nations are already having to do their bit. Romania, Bulgaria and Turkey signed this agreement back in January to start demining their parts of the Black Sea, if you like, because they've all been affected by this problem. They're either incidents involving shipping or they've had mines washing up on their shorelines. And they too obviously depend on the Black Sea for commerce. There's an economic driver here. So I don't think Ukraine would be alone. The Royal Navy, for instance, might play a part in a post-war mine clearance operation. And for Washington, this has become much more important, particularly since the downing of that American drone over the Black Sea last year. So the US, depending on obviously what happens in November, would also likely play a part. And just returning to Mike's point there, you know, the security of the Black Sea really is becoming a world issue. Ukraine has approximately a third of the world's most fertile soil, and more than 400 million people rely on foodstuff, the cereals Mike was talking about, the grain and the barley from Ukraine before Russia invaded back in February 2022.
Mike, we know that landmines can remain a threat for decades after a conflict finishes. And we heard from the previous person that you know, clearing them is like a 3D chess game. It's surely even harder to safely clear them from the sea.
Yes, it is. I mean, mines on the ground do actually shift a bit over time as soil changes and moves. But sea mines really do shift. I mean, they can come adrift in storms. They can come adrift because they're not anchored particularly well in the first place. I mean, sea mines are always washing up. And if enough of them are around, they will wash up on beaches. They will go drifting around. So sea mines are inherently more insecure once their initial, you know, purpose has passed. When a war has passed or the particular threat has passed, somebody's got to deal with sea mines, and they are much more difficult than landmines to deal with. The only difference is that with landmines are sown in the thousands and tens of thousands, sea mines are sown in the hundreds and low thousands, so there are fewer of them usually, but every one of them, every single one of them, can become a separate problem.
Sam, just really briefly, did you get any concept at all about how long it will actually take to clear the Black Sea? Does anyone actually have an idea, or is it something that's still in progress and you can't possibly say?
Yeah, I don't think anybody really knows how many mines are actually in there. Ukraine may know, Russia may know, but not really. It's a question I asked. I think there is a degree of frustration in terms of the Ukrainians about not being able to get into Black Sea and do the job. And, you know, returning to Mike's point he made earlier about going via the Danube, again, I asked that sort of question, are there other routes to get in? But I think the big obstacle there is the politics.
All right, Simon, good to speak to you. Thanks so much. Well, next we talk about Mark Rutter, a name we've mentioned very occasionally here on SITREP over the last decade or so, and you're going to be hearing it a lot more from now on, though. The former Dutch Prime Minister will be the new NATO Secretary General from October. That's when Jens Stoltenberg steps down after 10 years leading the alliance. Well, let's bring in Dr. Jamie Shea, former Deputy Assistant Secretary General at NATO. Good to have you on SITREP and good to see you again, Jamie.
Thanks for inviting me back, Kate.
How well do you know Mark Rutter?
Well, I'm not claiming that he's a close personal friend. He's obviously been Prime Minister of the Netherlands for the last 14 years, so he's had a lot more important things to do than keeping in touch with me. But he has been, of course, around, as I said, for a long time on the NATO circuit, attending NATO meetings and NATO summits. And I did serve under a former Dutch Secretary General called Jaap de Hoop Scheffer. The Dutch seem to have a stranglehold almost on the job of NATO Secretary General. Rutter will be the fourth Dutchman to occupy the position, and therefore through Jaap de Hoop Scheffer, who was my boss and friend for many years, I had some contact with Mark Rutter as well.
So what is the NATO Secretary General's job exactly? Are they a decision maker or just a figurehead?
Well, not a decision maker, but certainly more than a figurehead. I mean, decisions are taken, of course, collectively by the 32 allies in the North Atlantic Council. But the Secretary General, nonetheless, is more than just a secretary. He or she sets the agenda, decides what the ambassadors in the NATO Council are going to talk about, produces the papers, presents the decisions that he would like them to take. He works behind the scenes, you know, to mediate problems between the allies. He's a kind of super troubleshooter. And certainly the current incumbent, Jens Stoltenberg, has had to play that role with President Trump a few years ago, or with President Erdogan of Turkey in more recent times. And he has a lot of authority and a lot of influence, particularly when he has been a former prime minister, as of course Stoltenberg and Rutter are, and therefore knows everybody and can just pick up the phone phone and speak directly to a president or a prime minister or a foreign minister and sort out the problem. So not a decision maker, but certainly he is the person who drives the NATO machinery forwards, makes sure that, you know, decisions are taken, finds the consensus, preserves the unity amongst the allies, communicates it to the public, but then has to run a very complex organization. You know, NATO is a big international organization with a lot of agencies, a lot of people, and he has to be a good manager in driving implementation then through the bureaucratic machinery.
So basically, if you're going through the skills that are needed, you need to be good at leadership, management, you have to have communications, presumably being good at languages is good, diplomacy, anything I've missed there?
No, I think you've really written a better job description than I could. Somebody like Rutte, who's managed four coalition governments in the Netherlands, knows a lot about, you know, getting sort of difficult customers around the table and getting them to sign up to policies and implement as well. But of course, in addition to the personal qualities, you need a lot of stamina as well. The job's very demanding, 32 allies, they all have to be visited very frequently. Lots of partners around the globe, including, you know, as far distant as New Zealand, Australia, Japan, they have to be visited as well. You know, working the diplomatic machinery 24/7 and just having the physical stamina to sort of keep going for 4 years, or in the case of Stoltenberg, for 10 years, that's very important. When I worked for George Robertson, who was NATO Secretary General from the UK a few years back, he said the first thing he did on day one was to start looking for his successor, because he didn't want to be stuck in the job, given the physical and mental demands, more than 4 or 5 years. And that meant having somebody lined up who could succeed him.
Yeah, Mike, how much power do you see the Secretary General as having?
Well, as Jamie said, it's the power of persuasion, but it is helped by the fact that the SecGen is the representative of NATO. So if there's a single person that gives a NATO line on something, it has to be the SecGen. And so that representative function does give the Secretary General quite a lot of power in terms of the power of persuasion. But again, you know, we've got to remember that though NATO is the most impressive alliance the world has ever seen and remains the most impressive alliance in world history, it is a collection of 32 now national defence policies. You know, the NATO Secretary General and even SACEUR, the Supreme Allied Commander, has very little physical resource at their fingertips. So what they have to do is in terms of the national policies of all of the various members. But, I mean, if you think about it, as Jamie says, the SecGen has got to be a real chief executive officer. It's got to be a real CEO as well as a politician. And I'd say if you compare the NATO SecGen with, let's say, the president of the EU Commission, I would say that the NATO SecGen has probably got more pull and sway in NATO than the president of the Commission has in the EU. You know, more authority, more ability to be an effective persuader just because of the way NATO has to work. So it is quite a powerful position. But, I mean, as Jamie said, it requires multiple skills across a whole range of talents. And not many people have got that.
And presumably also, by that definition, how influential you are will depend on just how persuasive you are and how good a diplomat you are.
You're right. I mean, you've got to be fair vis-a-vis all allies. If you're seen to be, you know, in the pocket of France or in the pocket of the United States, always taking one side against the other, you'd lose that sort of authority very quickly. So defending the interests of all allies, being sympathetic to their positions, not criticizing them in public. I mean, there might have been times when Jens Stoltenberg would have loved to criticize Viktor Orban of Hungary or President Erdogan or President Trump, but he always refrained from doing so. So you're right. I mean, in public, you have to express unity in the positive side of NATO. But in private, obviously, you've got to have this ability to find consensus, to get compromise, you know, to live to fight another day if you can't get all of the decision done at once, and just preserve your sort of good offices as, you know, what we used to call in 19th century British diplomatic history as an honest broker, a fair-minded player. That's very important as well. I think an advantage of Rutte, by the way, is that coming from the EU, which was not the case of Stoltenberg, who is from Norway, he hopefully, understanding also how the complex EU machinery works, would be able to build more effective cooperation between the two big institutions at Brussels, NATO and the EU.
And Jamie, briefly, I mean, Mark Rutter really fits that mould, doesn't he, in that he is seen as a very even-handed, fair player. Is he really the only person that the whole alliance could compromise on and agree on?
Well, I think the choice of the selection, the pool, if you like, of candidates is pretty limited, Kate. But the other thing is that, as you know very well, and Mike too, when you've had somebody in a job for 10 years, there's always a debate, do we want the same, more of the same, continuity. You know, we basically want Stoltenberg Mark II because we're very happy with the kind of position that he's adopted. It's working. So let's find somebody similar. Or do we want to go off in a radically new direction, a different type of leader for a different age? And I think Rutter's selection shows that it's overwhelmingly option A, continuity. You know, somebody who's a good communicator, is well associated with assistance to Ukraine and has made the case for that, somebody who could handle Trump if he's re-elected in November, because he did it before, so he's got some experience, somebody who's going to get out there and make the case for higher defence spending, particularly now that Rutter has managed magically, finally, this year to get the Netherlands up to 2% of its GDP on defence. And that has, of course, given him more credibility in that particular area. So I think the Allies were looking for an available Prime Minister, but particularly one who would be in the same mould as Jens Stoltenberg.
And Mike, on that note, Donald Trump, Mark Rutter, he has been dubbed the Trump whisperer, hasn't he? If Donald Trump does return to the White House, is there a danger that the Secretary General's entire bandwidth will be taken up dealing with the US president?
It'll certainly take up a lot of it. And I think, you know, the phrase going around now is that NATO is trying to Trump-proof itself. But actually, it goes deeper than that because, I mean, you know, Trump is a particular issue if he becomes president again. But actually, NATO has got to America-proof itself a bit more, because regardless of who is president, it's undoubtedly true that the dynamics of American policy and European policy are not the same as they were 10 and 20 years ago, and they're going to need a different sort of relationship. The Europeans do have to do more in Europe for their own security. And I think that, you know, regardless of whether Trump is the next president or not, that sense that we've got to rebalance NATO, I think, is now accepted by all of the serious players within the organization. And a future Secretary General has got to address that as a long-term problem. Undoubtedly, if Trump is re-elected president, then that problem becomes more acute more quickly. But it's a more structural problem of you know, casting NATO into the 20 or 30 year future, which is where it, you know, wants to certainly be due into the middle of this century.
And Jamie, obviously supporting Ukraine is key. What else will be his strategic priorities? What they have to be?
Well, clearly, being a cheerleader for Ukraine at a time when there are signs of Ukraine fatigue, of course, on both sides of the Atlantic. Money is more difficult to get. Difficult decisions on, you know, more advanced weaponry and whether that weaponry can be used to attack Russia. It's not an easy time. And so maintaining that unity and consensus on Ukraine is going to be important, particularly at the time when Jens Stoltenberg, as he departs, is trying to get the Allies to commit to spending together $40 billion a year on aid for Ukraine for 5 years. And that's going to be a big ask. And Rutter, of course, will probably have to sort of carry that forward. The other thing is that NATO is taking on a more important role, already decided as the super coordinator for training and equipping the Ukrainian army, with a new NATO headquarters to be based at Wiesbaden to do that. So getting that structure up and running and then showing everybody that this is going to be more effective than the sort of current ad hoc Ukraine contact group that we've had under the chairmanship of the US Secretary of Defense, you know, that's going to be a challenge as well. So, like it or not, you know, Ukraine still a candidate for NATO membership, moving that process forward, keeping the Ukrainian army in the fight. It will take up a lot of his time. But the other side of that medal, of course, is NATO's collective defense. We've had a whole spate of exercises this year whereby the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, General Cavoli, wants to demonstrate NATO's capacity to implement the regional defence plans that NATO agreed at the Vilnius summit last year. And in Washington at the NATO summit, Cavoli will say, well, look, chaps, you know, we've had lots of exercises and basically we can do this. We can't do that. We can't get to Estonia in a week. We don't have enough air defence. We're not very good at, you know, data fusion. We need more artillery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of Rutte's time is going to have to be spent making sure that the Allies continue the modernization of their armed forces and work together. So that, you know, if all of these war warnings that we've been hearing around Europe recently about, you know, having to be ready to fight Russia in a few years' time, if they come true, then NATO is up to the job, really. So that's going to be the other side of the action vis-a-vis Ukraine. I think also how Rutte sort of develops the other side of NATO, you know, does he carry forward what Stoltenberg has been trying to do on climate change? You know, does he try to engage NATO more in Asia-Pacific affairs? Does he partner with the EU to look at terrorism in Africa, as Turkey would like NATO to do? You know, NATO can't just become, if you like, a one-trick pony. Yes, it's all about Russia, but other security problems have not gone away. And it'd be interesting to see how Rutte achieves a sort of balance among all of these different competing security interests and priorities.
Really good to have your thoughts. Dr. Jamie Shea, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Finally this week, the moment that made me. Each week this summer, a veteran tells us the story of the most pivotal point in their life and military career and what led to it. Professor Neil Greenberg is a world authority on military mental health. His research in Iraq and Afghanistan shapes the support given to British servicemen and women on operations today. He served on ships and submarines across the world, completing Arctic warfare training and earned himself a Commando's Green Beret. But in 1988, as a second-year medical student at Southampton University, he had no intention of joining the armed forces. So what happened? Neil Greenberg has been telling me about the moment that made him.
I was sitting at home on the Christmas holidays. I think it was before Christmas. And I was just listening to the radio whilst I was doing something. And on the radio comes the doctor, who was then the doctor on the QE2, so, you know, the cruise liner. And then he'd said he'd been in the Royal Navy, which had got him interested in being a doctor on board ships. And I thought, gosh, I never even knew the military had doctor. But I guess in my life, I always wanted to perhaps do something which is a bit exciting and a bit different. And so when I heard this doctor on the radio speak about the fact that he said they'd been to some foreign places and had some interesting diseases to treat, I thought, that sounds like a pathway which is different to the one that I thought I was going to have to do. One of my friends at university at the time, his brother was in the Navy. I knew that. And when I went back after Christmas, I said to Chris, did you know the Navy has doctors? You know, your brother's in the Navy. And Chris said, oh, yes, I do. And what's more, I'm going up to London in a couple of weeks' time to go and speak about joining the Navy myself. And I said, do you think I can come? And the military sent me a rail warrant, which is all very nice. It was a free train ticket. And so I went with Chris up to London to have an informal chat. And that kind of started off my, you know, my interest and then eventually my career in the Navy.
And so you got your free train ticket. You signed up. Tell me about your first postings and the impression they made.
After finishing Dartmouth and my basic training there, my first job, actually, interestingly, was a very brief one for 2 weeks at HMS Collingwood. And what was fascinating there is the doctor who was the senior doctor, he was a surgeon commander, he had been in the Falklands on one of the ships. I think it was Sheffield that sunk. And so I didn't know this chap at all. I turned up and, you know, he's a senior officer. I said, hello, sir. And he said, come into my office. Okay, so, yeah, well, whatever you want. And he it's the first day I met him. He sat me down and showed me picture books of what he'd experienced during the Falklands War. I mean, looking back now as a psychiatrist who's really interested in trauma, this was many years after the war. I think he was clearly affected by it. And so I listened and watched and spoke to him and went away thinking, gosh, you know, it was a funny thing to do straight away as the first thing when a junior doctor joins your department. Anyway, I did that for 2 weeks. And then I was very lucky. My first ship was HMS Monmouth, which was a Type 23 frigate. It was a relatively new ship. And I did a global deployment. So I went around the world, left in February 1995, came back in November, 30 port stops around the world. I went through the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal. One of the little stories I'll tell you there is, as we're going across the Atlantic, the weather was really, really bad. Now, of course, I haven't been to sea on a ship before, so what do I know? And I'm up on the bridge with the captain, and these waves are coming over the ship at the front. And I say, gosh, sir, you know, these waves are pretty big. And he went, oh, yes, doctor, you know, inexperienced doctor, yes, yes, yes. And then a huge wave came over. And I remember him going, actually, you're quite right, they are pretty big. And we ended up losing our bow dome in the Bermuda Triangle somewhere. We took quite a lot of damage. We had to go into port for about a week in order to have repairs made. The medical store on the ship was right at the folks were right at the front of the ship, the pointy bit. And it flooded. So the medical store flooded and there was water all in our disaster. We had all these disaster stores, which included things such as sanitary products for women, although it was an all-male ship, it was for disasters, but also plaster of Paris and, you know, pills. And they were in, who designed these things? They were in cardboard boxes. And so they're basically all sort of mushed together. And we had plaster of Paris and sanitary products with water. It was all a complete mess. And I didn't get massively seasick, but I did get a bit seasick. I remember my medical assistant going, sir, leave this with me. You go back to your cabin. And I remember thinking, you are a really good egg. My general view is at that point, I was interested in being a psychiatrist. And I managed to convince the appointers that what I wanted to do was not just stay on ships, but I wanted to see the Navy. So my next job after that ship was to go in a nuclear submarine. Now, on that trip, it was much more challenging as a doctor, because when you're underwater, you can't make a telephone call to anybody to ask for any help. So you had to make all the decisions. And we had some more serious cases there of people who really damaged themselves. Had one junior officer who developed testicular cancer. We had to send home. And I think, although I, again, did lots of other stuff, I earned my doctoring money more on that trip than I had in the ship, really. That for 7 months, and that was great. And again, I had to do all the things to become a submariner. So you have to, you know, do the submarine escape tank. You have to go around and learn where all the valves are on a submarine. There's no passengers on submarines. You have to be part of the team because there's a limited amount of people.
So was it that moment when you spoke about earlier that you spoke to that Falklands veteran? Was that the moment where you decided that mental health would be your focus? Or was that the real decision moment?
No, I think I had been interested because I really wanted to make a difference in my life. And I think people who don't know a lot about psychiatry assume that you do a lot of listening, but you don't necessarily get people better. And the good news I can assure you and listeners is that people do get better. And it was a great privilege and it still remains a great privilege to try and help them get back to having a decent life.
Tell me about your experience on HMS Nottingham. What happened?
So HMS Nottingham was a Type 42 destroyer, and it ended up in 2002 hitting a rock off the coast of Australia, Lord Howe Island, actually. And so basically, because the ship had been badly damaged, Fleet Command wanted psychological support to be provided. And so I went out with two warrant officers. One of them was Navy, one of them was Marines, and a Marine sergeant. And they said, so why are you here? And my colleagues, the Navy and Marine chaps, said, oh, we're the specialists. Because in their mind, they were here to be the psychological specialists. The people from HMS Nottingham thought we were salvage specialists. And so they were really quite excited to have salvage specialists here. And when they found out that we were psychological specialists, they were like, oh, we don't want anything to do with this. But we managed to coax them and we ended up and we did loads of really good supportive work.
And what do you want to research the effect on mental health of troops deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, we had lots of data for a long time on what happens after wars and after deployments. You know, does war affect you? But really, from an occupational point of view, the most important time we need service personnel to be psychologically fit is when they're at war, when they're doing their job. And so I led a small team. We went out to Iraq for the first time in 2009 to look at troops who were doing their duty in a war zone, because that's a bit about their mental health. We don't want them to be injured. But importantly for the military, it's about how do we optimize performance. So in the military, it's not just about we want to save people's mental health, which of course you do, but you really want people to do their job well. And that means they need to be psychologically healthy. There's very good evidence that people who have poor mental health perform poorly. And therefore, we had to gather data whilst they were doing the doing. So we had to go out to forward operating bases and patrol bases and gather data to find out what the mental health was at the time, because that then allows the operational commanders to know how they should deploy their troops and what they do with them.
And do you think that research has a legacy for today's servicemen and women?
Oh, definitely. The Omni, as it was called, the Operational Mental Health Needs Evaluation, that process is still used. And so absolutely, I think it does. And what it also allows a bit to do, I think the military still got more work to do on this, is to say, if we've had an operational deployment and we've had lots of psychological distress or casualties, then we need to plan for the future that actually we're going to have patients who are going to come our way.
And that moment, the moment that made you, what kind of person do you think it has made you?
I think it's made me someone who is able to help other people, which is something I wanted to do. It's led me to not just look at people's health generally, but also to look at how people perform. So hopefully I'm making a little bit of difference being a lot of places.
Professor Neil Greenberg, it's great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, Mike, for a man whose career must have involved an awful lot of listening to people, he's a great storyteller, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's got a lot of stories to tell. Yeah, very interesting.
At that moment when he says that there are no passengers on a submarine, it sums it up, doesn't it? There are no passengers in the armed forces. Whatever your specialism, you have to be able to be part of the whole unit as well.
Yeah, it's part of the culture, isn't it? I mean, you know, the serve to lead is the motto of the Royal Military College Sandhurst. And you know, Kate, I mean, I've dealt with or met so many people leaving the armed services, retiring from the armed forces in their 40s or 50s, who are moving into the civilian world. And some of them make the transition very easily, but a lot of them don't. And when, serving officers leave the military in any of the three services and find the transition difficult, when you chat to them about it, it is this lack of obvious commitment to the organization or to the unit itself. I mean, that is so automatic in the military. When it isn't that way in the civilian world, they find that very difficult because people are drawn to the military, or when they're in the military, they naturally get that sense that you are part of a team. And if you don't see yourself as part of a team, then you're just taking up space. Simple as that.
Mike, good to talk to you. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another Sit Rep next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes online at bfbs.com/sitrep, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.